righty, we'll find our speaker as soon as we do. All right, well, we're going to go out of order then. So usually what we do on this call is we start with our guest speaker, then we get our reports from the field, and then we go over this month's actions. Well, we're going to do it in a different order this month. So we will make sure we've tracked down Mr. Inglis and get him on the call. But in the meantime, what we'll do is we'll start with what happened since last month's call, and then we'll go over the actions for this month, including the laser talk, and then we'll complete the call by having our guest speaker unless he comes on in the middle of that. So let me just start actually in the 3rd District of Minnesota. So, John Howard, I think you have an announcement to make about what's happening there in the 3rd District. Are you there, John? You could star 6 your phone to unmute it because you probably muted it at this point.
Yep, I'm on, Mark.
I'm Mark. Yeah. Go ahead, I can hear you.
I can read my updates?
Yes, please.
All right. Well, my name is John Howard, and I'm the group leader here in the 3rd District of Minnesota. And yesterday, I became an official candidate with the state of Minnesota. I've been a candidate in the eyes of the Federal Election Commission since March and the Federal Congress since April. But yesterday, I filed to have my name on the GOP primary here in August. As part of the filing, I got a big folder of instructions and guides, a box of 500 blank voter registration cards, and a small hole in the campaign checking account, $300 filing fee. And in terms of holes, yesterday was also National Donut Day, for those who did not know. Fortunately, this meant I got a free donut at a donut shop and also provides a nice analogy for my campaign. We're trying to fill that hole in the middle of home. It may be a little corny, but I think it is fitting because it seems that we have polarized parties and a lot of folks on the fringes, but not enough people working in the middle. Thanks for the opportunity to speak, and have a great meeting.
That's great. Congratulations, John. So that means at this point, in terms of people that we're aware of, we know that Bill Barron, who started our Salt Lake City chapter, is running for Senate in Utah, and John Howard, who heads up the 3rd District group in Minnesota, is running for the House of Representatives there. That's just fantastic. You know, we exist for two reasons. One is to create the political will for a stable climate. But the second is for people to have breakthroughs in their personal and political power, and for someone to stick their neck out that far to actually be running for office is really remarkable, and congratulations, John, and we're really excited about both those campaigns. Who just joined the call?
Carolyn Dry, Winona.
Hey, Winona. Well, good. Who else?
This is Richmond again. We lost our connection.
Okay, well, good to have you back. Okay, well, again, we're going to do the call out of order because we're hunting down our speaker, and he's confirmed multiple times, so I know he's somewhere. It's just a matter of getting connected to the call. Amy Bennett, let's move on to the what's happened since last month's call. Can you hop on for a second?
Can you hear me, Mark?
I can hear you clear.
Okay,
good. So let's just go over a couple of the key things that happened since last month's call. So first of all, how many letters did we get published this month?
Mark, this month we had 30 letters to the editor published.
Okay, good. So 30 letters to the editor published this month. And I think it's important when we go over what got done every month that we don't think of this just in numbers. You know, one of our fundamental starting points is that politicians in general don't create political will, they respond to it. And our job is to generate the political will so it becomes impossible for them not to do what they should do. So that your letter, that one of that 30, is absolutely crucial to that happening and should be understood that sometimes, I mean, sure, we got one in the New York Times this month, but your one in your local paper is as important as anyone, and the volume of activity is really important. Here's how that fits in contextually in terms of what's happening. Last year, we had 102 letters to the editor published by our organization. This year, I think, Amy, with 30, that puts us at 162 year-to-date right now. Is that right?
That's right, Mark. We're on the road to doubling it easily.
Okay, so that's great work by everybody. Sorry?
Oh, I just wanted to add that in addition to that, you know, Nashville got their first letter to the editor published, and they haven't even had their group start yet. So we've got an LTE in the Tennessean, and they've got their editorial board meeting planned already, and a meeting with Senator Alexander in the district office set up all before their group starts.
Wow, that's very, very cool. We'll be down there in Nashville next week. We're very, very excited about that. Okay, then another area that we're have a lot of focus on is adding co-sponsors for the Save Our Climate Act. How many people do we? What's the total number of co-sponsors on the Save Our Climate Act now?
We're we're up to 16 co-sponsors.
Okay, so that means we added four more since last month, so that's significant. Thanks for everybody who's doing the outreach on that. That is really draws a lot of attention. It makes a big difference, so thank you for continuing to reach out to people and ask people to co-sponsor the Save Our Climate Act. And then in terms of organizations that have signed on as organizational signers on to the Save Our Climate Act, I know that Seattle has got the key committee of the for the Democratic platform to actually endorse SOCA. So that's significant. Anything else on that, Amy, that's reportable this month?
Mark, similar to that, Minnesota, Gene Johnson has told us from Alexandria that they think Minnesota will have the very same type of platform adopted. So we're looking forward to that.
Great. Okay, fabulous. Okay, and then what about meetings with members of Congress or Parliament? How many this month?
We had 8 meetings with Congress and members of Parliament.
Great. And that includes Judy Chu with the Pasadena group that just started a couple of weeks ago. Representative Chu was actually over at Jim and Michelle's home last Saturday for an hour and a half, so that's pretty significant. Okay, what about in terms of one of the things we start reporting this year is on this call we always report things that have happened, but we also start to report the number of appointments that are scheduled for the national conference. So how many appointments do you have both in terms of meetings with staff and with members of Congress set up for the conference at this point?
We have 27 meetings with staff members and 10 face-to-face. This is for July on Capitol Hill, so that's 37 total. And, Mark, I also wanted to mention that Dallas, or actually our members from Texas, have already started setting meetings in D.C., and they also don't have their group start set yet, but they're already making appointments for Capitol Hill in July.
Wow.
In addition to that, we've got 98 people registered for the conference coming from all over the United States and Canada to attend.
I didn't know that.
Okay, so then in addition to members of Congress, we do have requests in at the State Department, the Department of Energy, the World Bank, and then also with various media environmental organizations, so that will be a huge amount of leverage there. And then we had two fantastic fundraisers. Atlanta had a fundraiser, and Alexandria, Minnesota actually created something new that we didn't even know about. We got a bunch of checks in the mail from them, and we asked what happened, and what they said is they had something called an appreciation party. So I like it when somebody reframes something, because everybody knows what a fundraiser is, but Alexandria decided to call something about an appreciation party and raised a bunch of money and had a great time doing it, had a band, and even when it started to rain outdoors with a band, they moved everybody in the garage, and it went fantastic. The other thing that I think is significant, Amy, is I think there were 39 outreach events. Is that correct?
Everybody's been really busy with outreach events that include making presentations, tabling at festivals, that type of thing, 39 this month.
Great. And so that meant a lot of people making significant outreach to the public. Thank you all for doing that. You know, I know sometimes that can be long hours at tables doing talks to the public. So 39 events means we educated a lot of people on supporting the Save Our Climate Act. That's fantastic. Okay, let me check again. Bob Inglis, have you had a chance to join us yet?
I'm right here. Looking forward to talking with you.
Yay, Bob Inglis. The quality of my life and my blood pressure just went down significantly there. I'm going to mute everybody else for just one sec, Bob, so bear with me one second.
All guests have been muted. You can unmute your line by pressing *6.
Okay, Bob, let me just make sure I can hear your voice because I muted everybody else for a second. Can you say something?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, fabulous. Great. And Marshall Saunders, our founder and president, would you please go ahead and introduce Representative Inglis?
Yes, Mark. Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay, great. Well, Bob, welcome to the call. We're just delighted to have you. And so now to my CCL partners, I just want to say a few words about Bob Inglis. When he was in the U.S. House of Representatives, Mark and Steve and I called on him and his staff numerous times, and we all became good friends. We had a lot of laughs in that office and a lot of support for each other. Bob was graduated from Duke University. He received a law degree from the University of Virginia, Charlottesville, and went into private practice in Greenville, South Carolina. And there, he was on the executive committee of the Republican Party in Greenville County. Bob served as one of the more conservative Republicans in the United States House of Representatives for six terms. In the 110th Congress, he introduced a tax swap bill, steadily reducing payroll taxes, offset by steadily increasing taxes on carbon dioxide. And it was a brilliant bill, and we loved it. About that time, Bob was interviewed by the Miami Herald, who asked him, how can a conservative Republican from South Carolina take the political risk of introducing a bill in Congress to save the climate system? And Bob responded, members of Congress should either do the right thing or go home. And so I am honored to present to you, my CTO partners, a man of great courage, Bob Inglis. Now, Mark is going to lead the interview, but again, Bob, welcome to the call.
Well, thank you, Marshall, and thank you, Mark.
Yeah, Bob, let me just tell you one thing about the people you're speaking to, and then we'll turn the call over to you for a little bit. So I want to read you something very short that Buckminster Fuller said. He said, something hit me very hard once, thinking about what one little man could do. He said, think of the Queen Mary. The whole ship goes by, and then comes the rudder. And there's a tiny little thing at the edge of the rudder called a trim tab. It's a miniature rudder. Just moving the little trim tab builds a low pressure that pulls the rudder around. It takes almost no effort at all. So I said that the little individual can be a trim tab. Society thinks it's going right by you, and it's left you altogether. But if you're doing dynamic things mentally, the fact is you can just put your foot out like that, and the whole big ship of state is going by. So I said, call me trim tab. And I think that that would be the best way to relate to the people you're speaking with today, or these aren't people who are looking for excuses about why big things aren't going to happen. They're people who say, I'm up to making big things happen. So welcome, and the floor is yours, sir.
Well, thank you, Mark, and thank you, Marshall, for that very kind introduction. Apologies for the little confusion on our end, not on the not on your end, but my end on the timing. Something about confusing time changes or something. But anyway, or time zones. But I'm very happy to be with you because two reasons. One, I got to return Marshall's kind words. In addition to being a supporter, Marshall Saunders became my friend in the midst of our last campaign in particular. You know, quite often you have supporters in campaigns, but they're not necessarily friends. In other words, you're happy to have their support, but you wouldn't want to go to dinner with them. But in the case of Marshall, he's somebody I'd very much want to go to dinner with and have very much enjoyed time with, and I'm really excited about his willingness to work on the Citizens Climate Lobby and to make all this happen. And to all of you listening, thank you for being this network of folks. I was listening on the call for a little while before I was added, and I was able to tell that you were already doing good business, even though I was tardy on arrival, because you've already gotten some things, reports underway here and things planned. And what Mark was just reading really is correct. You are, the folks on this call are able to turn this ship of state, and I believe that that you can do that. You know, I'm reminded, I'm a Republican, a conservative Republican, but before I ever ran for Congress, I remember going to a Young Democrats meeting on condition that no role would be taken, you understand. And so there was a friend of mine in my law firm who took me, and Griffin Bell, who was a former Attorney General, he was Attorney General for Jimmy Carter, said something very interesting. He said, you know how Jimmy Carter got elected president, and then got elected governor of Georgia. He said, six or seven of us got together and decided Jimmy should be governor. He said, you know how Jimmy Carter got elected president? said the same six or seven of us got together and decided Jimmy should be president. Well, now, Georgia, and there's some people on this call from Georgia, I hope, has some powerful and wealthy people, but I don't think that Griffin Bell was saying that they bought the office in any way. It's rather just that a handful of people committed themselves to the task of getting Jimmy Carter elected president, and it worked. Now, that's not from my party. I'm a Republican, but it's still an inspiring story that it really is just a matter of people getting together and deciding to commit themselves to it. And so a case of Citizens Climate Lobby, Marshall, Mark, Steve, others have committed themselves to this. You on this call have committed yourselves to this, and it can happen. And what is it that's going to happen, I hope? Well, what I'm hoping is that we figure out a way to price carbon. And if we do that, as a conservative Republican, I believe that the free enterprise system will deliver a solution. Now, there's some progressives on this call. I think my friend Ann Kelly might be on this call. I'm sort of outing her as a progressive. She probably doesn't mind, though. But she would agree with me on that, and I'm going to say these things as though only conservative Republicans could believe them. But the truth is that many progressives would also believe the same thing, that if you price carbon, then the free enterprise system can deliver a solution. And what I'm talking about here, of course, is some mechanism of attaching a price to carbon so that you internalize the negative externalities, the negative effects, the hidden cost of burning fossil fuels. If you attach those to the product, to coal, to petroleum, to natural gas, then what you do is you make an accountable system, you fix a market distortion, and then free enterprise can deliver solutions. Because right now, the sun is shining beautifully here in South Carolina, and I'm embarrassed to tell you that I don't have a solar hot water heater on my roof. If you go to Israel or Jordan or anywhere like that, which is about our same latitude, you'll see solar hot water heaters on every roof. But not here in South Carolina. Reason? My electricity is so cheap that I don't even know how much it costs. Per kilowatt hour. I don't know. It's so cheap. But it's cheap until you consider all the hidden costs. About 50% of our power here in South Carolina comes from nuclear. It has no emissions, and I'm a big fan of nuclear. Some people aren't, but I am. The coal-fired electricity, though, has hidden costs. If I were paying those costs at the power meter right now on my house, I'd be calling on Monday morning to a solar hot water heater installer and saying, can you get me a system on my roof to make hot water? Because a third of my electricity in this house goes to hot water, generating hot water. So the fact that I don't do that is owes directly to to my not having a price signal. To me not being aware of my need. If I were aware of my need, as you say, if I were aware of the cost, I'd be calling up a solar hot water heater person to get it on the roof of my house. And what are these costs I'm talking about? Well, in the case of coal-fired electricity, it's 23,600 people in the United States who die prematurely each year because of emissions from coal-fired plants. It's 3 million lost work days in the United States because of coal-fired electricity emissions. That's the soot, the small particulates that are coming out of those stacks. If the cost of those 23,600 people that die prematurely each year and the 3 million lost work days were attached to the cost of that electricity, I'd see how much my electricity is costing, and I would be innovating. I'd be doing what economists call substitution, technological substitution. But because those costs are hidden from me, I don't innovate. and therefore I'm not driving wealth creation by creating whole new systems, whole new drive in the economy. I'm not improving our national security because my car, which is dependent on petroleum, has the same small particulate problem, and so I'm not accountable for that. And I'm, of course, not cleaning up the air because I'm just participating in this coal-fired electricity. So the key is to attach those costs and to make it so that coal is fully accountable and petroleum is fully accountable. If so, then all kind of exciting things would happen. Now, there is an argument that my fellow conservatives make. And by the way, I should point out that I'm pretty conservative. Anytime you hear a Republican talking about climate change, you got to assume, well, it's probably a moderate. Well, I got moderate friends. Sherry Boulder, for example, is a dear friend of mine, a former member of Congress from New York. Sherry's a moderate. He once told me if it would help me, he'd come down here to South Carolina and say, Bob Inglis tried out to be a moderate. We checked him out. We rejected him. He is no moderate. I thought about having Sherry come down here and say that. It might have helped me in my last race. But when I'm saying I'm a conservative, let me just quantify that for you. 93 American Conservative Union rating, 100% Christian Coalition, 100% National Right to Life, A with the NRA, National Rifle Association, zero with the Americans for Democratic Action, that's a liberal group, and 20 by some mistake with the AFL-CIO. I really wanted a zero. So pretty conservative fellow, right? So because I'm pretty conservative, I've obviously got many conservative friends and allies, I'm familiar with an argument that travels in our circles, in conservative circles, which is, oh no, you can't attach those costs to petroleum and the coal. If you do, the price of electricity will go up, and the price of gasoline will go up. To which I say to my fellow conservatives, are you so progressive and so liberal, clouding ahead in your clouds, that you don't? Did you actually believe that there's such a thing as a free lunch? Do you really believe in the tooth fairy? Santa Claus, maybe, that there's such a thing as a free lunch. No, we're paying all the cost of coal-fired electricity. We're just not paying at the meter. I'm paying all right. Right now in my house, like I say, I don't have a solar hot water heater because my electricity is so cheap because I'm not paying at the meter. But my health insurance premiums are astronomical. The cost shift down at Greenville Hospital System is a substantial problem. The cost of Medicare and Medicaid that I'm paying through what I consider exorbitant taxes are going to people who have those lung ailments that are going to the hospital, getting care, being paid for by either Medicare or Medicaid in some cases, or by my insurance company causing my rates to go up, or by cost shift, which causes all the above to go up. So those small particulates end up somewhere. They end up in the lungs of the lung impaired. Those people go to the hospital. Those costs are real. And they get added, but they get added to our health care costs. And so because I don't see it on my electricity bill, I don't innovate. So what I'm excited about, what Marshall, Mark, Steve, everyone on this call is about, is trying to get real accountability, and I would submit it's really biblical accountability for people that are generating electricity by fossil fuels or dealing in petroleum. It's okay, fine, those are useful products. Just be fully accountable, though, for all your cost. Because, you know, in biblical law, I can't do something on my property that harms your property. If I do, if I say have ash coming out of my stack and it's falling on your property, you have a cause of action against me under biblical law. That's the same under English common law, which really adopted sort of biblical law. English common law was adopted by the Americans in the colonies and thereafter. And now that's our law. And it all goes back to these concepts of accountability. And so what I hope to see is this network of folks that we're talking to today talking to both progressives, of course, because they're maybe inclined to do something about climate change, but also speak to conservatives, conservative members of Congress, and say, what we're after here is accountability. And that's a key concept for conservatives. And so if we can get that price signal, I believe we'll create innovation, and the result will be a lot more wealth, people making a profit. And I think profit is a very good thing, because in a wonderful capitalistic system, you make money by serving somebody else's need. And once people realize what their need is, they'll be glad to have it served. So let me stop there, Mark, and give you an opportunity to ask questions or others.
Yeah, Bob, what I'm going to do, Bob, is I'm going to open it up to a couple of groups in just a minute. So it, depending upon time, we'll start Minnesota's 3rd District, then Chicago, then Pasadena, then Hamilton, Portland, Eugene. We'll just depending upon time. Let me just ask you one thing, Bob, in terms of kind of a general broad question. I know that Sweden passed a carbon tax in 1990, and it's actually pretty expensive. They charge €100 a ton. And since 1990, their emissions have dropped by 7%, and their GDP has grown by 36%. So I think that's a pretty compelling argument for people who think that if putting a price on carbon is potentially damaging to the economy. But are there other things that you tell people about the upside to the economy?
Well, yeah, this is something that's real important to me. It's, I'm glad you asked, because it's a key concept to pass on to conservatives, and it's just and that is the concept of revenue neutrality. The example you're talking about is helpful, and it's clear that some countries have done this and it hasn't harmed them. In the case of the United States, what I'd like to see is revenue neutrality, that we are not increasing taxes by pricing carbon. So if we're going to put a price in carbon, then let's reduce taxes elsewhere or figure out a way to dividend that money back to the taxpayers, so that we're not growing government. And this is a key point for me and for other conservatives, is that one of the big problems of cap and trade was that it was a substantial increase in the size of government and a big new tax. Well, we're not for that. I voted against cap and trade for that reason, and the fact that it decimates American manufacturing, and the fact that it doesn't do anything to China and India. All those reasons, it's a non-starter in my book. But a revenue-neutral tax shift, where you shift the tax from payroll or income tax on the carbon dioxide in a totally revenue neutral way, so that there's no increase in the size of government, no increase take by the government. That's very powerful. And Mark, the reason that I got onto that is that when you said €100 per ton, is the bill that I introduced that Marshall referenced earlier was $15 a ton, rising to $100 a ton over 30 years' time. But I was happy to go higher than $100 a ton, as long as there was a corresponding tax cut elsewhere. And that's the key. As long as you balance it with the tax elsewhere, let's go up on that carbon tax. Let's make it so the price is real carbon. Redo the tax to negative externalities.
Yeah, we're with you on that. We have been pushing for revenue neutrality all along, and it was inspired by actually the bill that you wrote. Let's start with Minnesota's 3rd District, then we'll go to Chicago. So, John, if you could *6 your phone, that'll unmute you, and then once you ask the question, if you could mute your line again, that'd be great. So, is someone there in the Minnesota's 3rd District?
Hi, Mark, if we're here.
Okay, go ahead, speak up, please.
We hear about a number of different bills. There's so much, like Save Our Climate Act, and the Food Welfare Act, and I'm just kind of wondering about the long-term strategy, the two-year strategy. I wonder if you can kind of put that in perspective so we can kind of understand how these are being integrated, or are they going to be competing energies, or where could you clarify that for me?
Mark, maybe a little bit of assistance there on understanding.
Let me just clarify something for you, Bob. So we actually put together a two-year plan. We are looking very intensely at the first year of next year's Congress of saying that that's the period in which we have to get something done because the second part of a term, everybody goes into reelection mode. So we actually generated a two-year plan, and we've been working on it and been working to generate some bipartisan coalition in the meantime behind the scenes, because it's difficult, particularly for Republicans, to say that they're for doing something on climate change right now, given the climate in D.C. So I think he's referring to the two-year plan that we created to get something done in the first year of the next Congress.
Yeah, so I see three possibilities. One is there's some folks working on a lame duck strategy. In other words, that after this election in November, there'll be a two-month period where perhaps the Congress might act on a grand bargain to deal with our structural deficit. A great way of dealing with that structural deficit is to adopt a carbon tax as part of that. Just change what you tax. That's a possible strategy. Second one that you just articulated, Mark, is that no wait, hope for that. I guess you and I both hope for that, the lame duck strategy. If it works, great. If it doesn't, then you've got a good fallback position, which is work in the first year of the next Congress. The third possibility is one that my organization anticipates, is that really we're talking probably 2015 or 2016, before there's enough market pressure to cook a grand bargain, to force Republicans and Democrats to come together to find a way to deal with the structural deficit. A great solution in either one of these three scenarios, either that it's lame duck or citizens' climate lobbies, two-year strategy, or what I'm thinking, which is 15 or 16, is in all three of those scenarios, what we're basically suggesting, I think, is that if you want to deal with a structural deficit, the great thing to do is to just change what you tax. It's part of a grand bargain.
Yeah, and so would you think that with the different scenarios, including the, you know, the debt ceiling having to be lifted and the tax cuts expiring, all of those, there's potential revenue that could be generated from a carbon tax, I would think?
Right, and chance favors a prepared mind. I think Einstein said that. So you need to be ready.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm grateful for folks on this call and what CCL is doing. Is you get ready, and then you can seize the moment. If it comes in the lame duck, I'm sure we'll all be very happy. If it comes the following year, great. If it doesn't come until 15 or 16, well, we'll take it when we can get it.
Okay, great. Okay, well, let's check with Chicago then. Chicago, Elizabeth, I think someone had a question there.
Some of the climate bills introduced in Congress have sought to impose a carbon fee not only on coal, oil, and gas, but also on biomass. Although some biofuels, such as ethanol from corn, are regarded as controversial, most scientists regard biomass itself as essentially carbon neutral, especially non-corn biomass, such as farm wastes, energy crops, and wood. There are new advanced methods in development to make renewable gasoline and diesel fuel from various kinds of biomass, but including biomass under a carbon fee would seriously impede these efforts. As a resident of a state with extensive forest resources that could be a source of renewable motor fuels, what are your thoughts on this?
Great question. First of all, I really like all those things. I'm very excited. I was on the Science Committee when I was in Congress and on Foreign Affairs. I'm very excited about all those technologies you're talking about. And I agree about ethanol from corn. It's not so great in terms of the energy equation, but if you can get it from other places, well, that's just terrific. And so I'm excited about all those things. And then, now what I'm about to say that sounds like inconsistent with what I've just said, because now my head is going to sound different than my heart. I've just expressed my heart, now I'm going to express my head. But hold on. If you get through to the second point here, I think you'll see how it works. First point, which is really hard to take from what you just said, is what if we eliminate all subsidies for all fuels, all of them? That means no subsidies for oil and gas. That means no subsidies for coal. That means actually charging real rates for land out west, not the giveaway rates. That means eliminating all the tax provisions for oil and gas leasing rigs that are special to them, and maybe even some that aren't special to them but apply to everybody. It's just sort of get rid of those loopholes. They're not necessarily loopholes. That's a pejorative and charge term. They're tax subsidies. They're ways that incentivize certain technologies. What if we eliminate all of those? So now everybody, all of them are gone. Now at this point, all the technologies you just mentioned are gasping, and wind and solar are on the floor thinking they're out of here. This is the big one, as Fred Sanford used to say on that TV show. But then second, hang on to it for the second point, which is, what if we then attached all cost to all fuels? And what if we said, you got to be accountable for all of your costs? Then what would happen is all those fuels that were just on the floor gasping for air suddenly rise up, and they say, you know what? I can beat petroleum in some ways. And you know what? I can beat coal if you give me the chance to have, or you say to coal, you be responsible for all your costs, petroleum, you be responsible for all your costs, then we can have a fair level playing field. And as a conservative and somebody that believes in free enterprise, that works for me, and it works for people that I know in politics. It's a, we don't want the government picking winners and losers, choosing which of those fuels to favor with tax incentives, but rather saying nobody's got any tax incentives. You're all on level playing field. Now compete and see who wins.
Great. We're with you on that also, Bob. Thank you. Okay, last question. Pasadena Hills, I apologize for Hamilton, Portland, and Eugene. We're not going to be able to get to you this month, but I owe you a question. Pasadena, Jim, does anybody there have a question this morning?
Yeah, we do. Thanks, Bob, for being on the call. We're very interested in how we are accruing the externalities beyond just particulate matter. And it seems like at a certain point, I know in your bill, we were going to use the payroll tax to, make it revenue neutral. We're interested in how you feel that conservatives would receive any bill, how we can take all those externalities and accrue them in a revenue neutral way back to citizens, presumably through the Citizen Climate Lobby. How do you feel that could be, sold back to the, your party and your constituency and from the conservative side?
Yeah, well, great question. I got to say, Mark and Marshall, Steve, it's wonderful to be on the call with people who think so deeply about these things and ask questions that are sort of at the graduate school level, the 601 level rather than the 101 level. It's fun to talk to the 101 too, but this is a call with people who've really studied this and are on to the intricacies of this. What I'd say is when in driving toward revenue neutrality, there are a number of ways to get there. My bill it would have reduced payroll taxes. I like a payroll tax reduction for two reasons. One, administrative simplicity. It exists. It's just, in other words, the payroll tax exists. To reduce it is fairly simple as an administrative matter. It involves very little paperwork or sending out of checks, let's say. The second reason that I like the payroll tax is the means of getting toward revenue neutrality. The payroll tax is a terribly regressive tax, arguably a carbon tax is also regressive. So if you're balancing that carbon tax with an offsetting reduction in payroll taxes, then you're making progress on removing some of the regressivity that could come with the imposition of a price on carbon. But there are other arguments. I think Cantwell Collins can make good argument that a dividend check back to consumers is a great way to get political buy-in, and I can agree with that. Another way to do it is to not reduce payroll taxes, but to reduce marginal income tax rates. That's something that Art Laffer, who is a collaborator with me on these topics and trying to convince conservatives that really this is our story, this is our song, that we want to really reduce taxes on something you want more of, which is income, and impose a tax, shift the tax, on something you want less of, which is CO2. And Art Laffer, by the way, says he's an agnostic. He doesn't know whether he's going to, he just says he doesn't know whether climate change is real or not, but he says he doesn't need to know. All he needs to know is you're taxing something you want more of, which is income. You're not taxing something you're arguably less of, which is CO2. So he says, change what you tax. It's a no-brainer. I hope that conservatives will hear him say that, and it really does make a whole lot of sense. And then another possibility for a way of reduction is, and this is the kind of thing that maybe causes some progressives some heartburn, is what about eliminating the corporate income tax? If you talk that way to conservatives, that can really get them excited that, let's eliminate the corporate income tax and shift that tax to carbon. So any of those is possibility as far as I'm concerned. We picked payroll in my bill because of the regressive nature, because of the administrative simplicity, but also, truth be known, because at that point Democrats were in control of the Congress and the chances of getting a marginal tax rate reduction were near zero. But getting Nancy Pelosi, say, to go along with a payroll tax reduction would be a much easier thing. But all those are possibilities. As long as it's revenue neutral, I think we can. I think conservatives can say, "Yep, that's for us."
Yeah, and we've actually gotten an enormous amount of receptivity from a lot of conservative offices and visits over the last couple of years. So, Bob, our organization's always really had two heroes, and in both cases, it's been because of courage. You and Dr. James Hansen, and we think that the messenger in many cases is important as the message. We're really grateful that you could be on the call with us and really, really believe that you are a really crucial part to us being able to pull something off. So thank you so much for making yourself available today.
Well, thank you, and apologies again for the late start for me, but I hope you accomplished many things before that, and many thanks again to Marshall for his leadership and what you're doing, Mark and Steve. For all the people on this call, thank you for being involved. It is a citizen's effort, and you're going to get it done.
Great. Thank you, sir, so much. All right, so then we have two things left to do today. One is we want to hear what we're doing in Canada, including the highlights of the Canadian Laser Talk, and then the same thing for the U.S. So, Kathy and Sudbury, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, can you speak up?
Yes, I can. Is this better?
Yep, perfect. Go ahead.
So this month in Canada, we're focusing on something quite different than in the United States. We have joined a huge movement in Canada called Blackout Speak Out, and we're speaking out against an omnibus budget bill that includes a lot of Trojan horses in it. So I will... And this happens this Monday. And it's called Blackout Scout, and it was brilliantly written by Cheryl in Toronto.
Well, there's no need to feel...
Yep. So Marshall, hold on a second, Kathy.
Yep.
Hold on a second. I just want to make sure Marshall needs his phone. Okay, go ahead, Kathy, sorry.
Okay, no problem. Okay, so here's June's Laser Talk, brilliantly written by Cheryl McNamara in Toronto. And I'm going to shorten it just a bit, and I'm going to... If you have a pen and paper ready, I'm just going to add an update to the numbers. So to June's Laser Talk, speak out during blackout, speak out. Today I'm joining over 400 civil society groups and well over 18,000 Canadians to speak out against Bill C-38. This legislation would throw up more than 60 existing federal statutes, including environmental protections, and scrutinize the political activities of environmental charities. We are speaking out because charities are being targeted. We are speaking out because Canadians' participation in Parliament is being disrespected. We are speaking out because nature is being put at risk. We are speaking out because too much power is in the hands of too few. We are speaking out because trusted advisors to the government that provide high-quality analysis for balanced policy are being ignored. Representative, will you join us and speak out against Bill C-38? Will you join us and speak up for full democratic participation by all parties in our energy future? And will you support a Canadian energy strategy that embraces the new energy transition that focuses on conservation and renewable energy? Go Trim Tabs!
Well said, Kathy, and Cheryl, brilliantly written again. Thank you so much. All right. Steve, what are we doing in the U.S. this month?
Well, in the U.S. this month, we're going to be asking people to contact someone that they know, preferably outside of their community, to join the next introductory call for Citizens Climate Lobby, which is happening this Wednesday. And so that's what our laser talk is geared to this month. And then the second action that we have this month is for people to do right at your meetings today, and that's to send a letter to your member of Congress. You can have, some folks write to your representatives, some folks write to your senators, but there's been legislation that was introduced recently in the House and the Senate to eliminate subsidies for coal and oil and fossil fuels. It's called the End Polluter Welfare Act. This is a bill that's being pushed very heavily by 350.org. And so on your action sheets this month, you'll see some talking points for that bill, and we're encouraging people to write to their members of Congress and ask them not only to support the legislation, but to go ahead and co-sponsor it. So here's the laser talk, getting back to the first action, which is to invite people to the next introductory call. Here's the laser talk for this month. I am solving the world's global warming problem. We're going to do the most exciting and interesting thing that will happen in our lifetimes. We're going to convert the entire world's energy system to renewable clean energy. We're going to do this by proving that regular people like you and I have more influence over politics than people who can write gigantic checks. We have a call coming up on Wednesday, June 6th, that lasts about 45 minutes to an hour. On that call, there will be enough of a description of what we are working on to see if this is something for you. Would you like the information on how to join this call?
Okay, great, Steve. Thank you so much. Very nicely said. So one of the things we included on the action sheet in the U.S. is a list of states where we don't have groups and people would either be on the Ways and Means or the Senate Finance Committee. Why do we focus on Ways and Means or Senate Finance? Anything that would be considered a fee on carbon, a tax, would have to go through Ways and Means in the House, would have to go through Senate Finance in the Senate. So if we can add groups in the states where we don't have for those committees, it adds an enormous amount of leverage of us first being able to get through the key committee that we have to and then onto the House and Senate floor. So the reason that those states are listed is because those are very high-value states. In particular, we want you to invite everybody you can to the introductory call, but those states in particular have additional importance. One thing about that also, the national conference starts on Sunday night, but we do a group start session the afternoon before the actual conference starts. Several groups last year started their group at the conference, so it's very likely that people you invite on this Wednesday's introductory call could come to the conference and start their group and be up and functioning with us in Washington, D.C. this summer. So everybody, thank you for a great month. A lot of stuff happened again this month. Let's go make a lot of big things happen. Big week in Canada this week. A lot of people are going down to Ottawa for Lobby Day. We'll be really excited to hear about that on next month's call. Thanks for all you're doing. Have a great month, everybody. Bye now.